Over 50 years ago, Peter Edelman began his career as a senior advisor to Robert F. Kennedy, touring impoverished areas of the country in preparation for legislation to alleviate the suffering of millions. Edelman worked closely with Kennedy until his death in 1968, and since then has continued work as an anti-poverty scholar, activist, lawyer, and teacher. Currently, he is professor of law at Georgetown University School of Law and author of an earlier book, So Rich, So Poor. His new book is Not a Crime to Be Poor, where he delves into the Justice Department's Ferguson Report, which exposed to the world a system of fines and fees levied for minor crimes that proved too expensive for Ferguson's largely poor. Again, the name of the book is Not a Crime to Be Poor, The Criminalization of Poverty in America. Peter Edelman is our guest. Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine, and you, and thank you.
Give us a sense of what brought you to want to look at this subject in this way.
I've worked on poverty issues for decades, and it was new to me to find out after what happened in Ferguson, Missouri, after the death of the killing of Michael Brown, that in that little city, they were doing this weird thing. They were arresting their own people and people who happened to wandered into the town and arrest them on all kinds of things with huge fines and huge fees. And then if they couldn't pay, they would end up in jail. And then we found because of the work of the Department of Justice, that would be with President Obama, it was going on and had been for some time, and we just hadn't put connected the dots. It's all over the country. It's an absolutely huge thing, and it's not just the fines and fees that's bad enough, but also money bail that goes with it. So once I understood what was going on, I needed to write a book.
So how did we get to that point where that became the norm in many municipalities across this country?
Starts with money. Money that the starting with the Reagan years and the having the rebellion against taxes and the big cuts in federal taxes, but then taken up by states and localities around the country, and somebody's said, we got to find money somewhere, and so I think it sort of happened in the on this as early as the late 80s or early 90s, here and there and there, and really getting bigger and bigger. So it's about trying to find money to run these court systems, smaller cities, you know, when you have somebody who can pay, it's annoying, but it goes all down to people who can't pay, and really in large numbers, and so it's absolutely awful. But it starts because of the need of revenue, and then what goes with it, there's no question that it's also issues about race that go with it, particularly with the low-income people.
I realize this may be a naive question, but somewhere along the way, why weren't people standing up and saying, this is not fair, this is racist, this should not be the case?
I just think that people didn't know, you know, they knew in their town it's going on and it seems weird, but they don't understand that it's happening, you know, in some place down the road. It's a little bit like you have your back you're having trouble, and then you start hearing about it from other people. I think for some period of time, these things were local and they sort of didn't travel in terms of understanding that this is a national. I mean, this is my theory on it because it was clearly going on for a very long time. Florida had going back to 1996, 20 new fines and fees, large amount of money, and then when people couldn't pay on these payment plans, it would mount up. It became a national thing to take away people's driver's licenses. Again, same question that you're asking. Why didn't people understand that this was happening as it now is in over 40 states? And the best I can say is that it seemed to be a local thing.
You write in the book about these money bail systems. Talk a little bit about how they work and how they were set up.
Well, on the bail, it's bigger than the fines and fees. It's a tool in the fines and fees, but that everybody knew it was there, and they just assumed that you couldn't do anything about it. And now we find in the last few years you can, either in legislation or in litigation. But we have 700,000 people on any given day in the country in jails, not prisons, and 450,000 of those people aren't guilty of anything. They're waiting for trial because they couldn't come up with a bail, which is typically $500. And these are junky little things where they would hold people on misdemeanors and violations and things like that. And it's another way of getting money because if they can't pay, the only way they can get out is to plead guilty. And then they get a payment plan, and then they can't pay on that, and that mounts up. But that's on lots and lots of people. The bigger thing, it's the whole system in the country that people, and one of the things in it, you know, I don't think that in particularly in the big cities, they can't try everybody. So the thing that really has to be there is to make people be forced to say that they're guilty when they're not, because they're literally not able in these cities to run trials. So the whole system was built on the basis of money bail, where people couldn't pay the money for the bail. That's been true for a long, long time, and nobody had done anything about it. And finally, we've had some wonderful young lawyers, and it connects back to the fines and fees in terms of doing something about it. And so now we see wins in the states. We see legislation, for example, just this year in New York State. It's a wonderful reform that people had wanted for a long time. And, of course, that story is because finally the Democrats took over the legislature and Governor Cuomo signed the law. And so now going forward in New York State, it's a whole new system, and large, large numbers of people don't have to be held at all. I mean, again, they're junky little things. They'll show up. They will show up for trial. A lot of them shouldn't be crimes at all, but they've been arrested. They don't have to be held for bail. So that's happened at the state level in places around the country and in the courts. And that's making a really big difference now. We just have to do it in the whole country.
Peter Edelman is a professor of law and public policy and the faculty director of the Center on Poverty and Inequality at Georgetown University Law Center. He is the author of the new book, Not a Crime to Be Poor, The Criminalization of Poverty in America. Let's talk a little bit in detail about those fines and fees. And basically, it seems you can fine anybody however much you want. There's really no ceiling on that, is there?
Well, in theory, particularly in a Supreme Court case just this spring, the constitutional says that excessive fines are unconstitutional. We haven't tested that at the state level because that's a new thing. The short answer to the question is the state basically can have it at any level that one, and that's the fine. And then on top of that, the fee that goes with it for anything that the state says is a key. You know, they have to have books in the court, municipal court library, for example, but a whole lot of other things. So I've got a guy in just one example of thousands named Adis Benjamin, and he has a disability, and he doesn't read or write, and he was out in his backyard cutting down the lawn, and they were arrested him for not having a permit. and he gets a fine of $500, and he gets fees of $518 more, and of course he can't pay any of it. So that's just one example. The other thing that's huge on all of this is taking away people's driver's licenses, and of course anybody listening knows somebody. And most likely they know somebody who can't pay. And, of course, then you end up driving your car anyway because you got to get to your job or buy some, you know, the groceries or take the kids to school. And so that's the big thing, actually. All over the country there are those individual stories, like I just said, or somebody who was drinking a beer on his front lawn, and this is a real story, and they come and arrest him and take him away because he's sitting outside of his house outside with an open beer can. Well, what are you talking about? But that's what they do. But the big thing that's over and over again is taking away the driver's licenses. And this, all of this is very big business. We're talking about, we don't know exactly, it's probably more than what I said, but the estimates are 10 million people who owe money of these kinds, debts one kind or another that they haven't been able to pay from the courts, and owing about $50 billion. So it's enormous. It's really business, terrible business.
When it comes to the business, you write in the book fairly early about the criminalization of mental illness. How are they making money off those arrested as a result of mental illness?
Well, there's a bunch of things that I call the overall book criminalization of poverty. And so there are things about that we don't think about that are really, really terrible problems. Sending kids to a court for some little thing that should have gone to the school principal, you know, just some skirmish on the playground or something like that. So these aren't money things. The issues are terrible of women who wanted protection from the police, and these ordinances say that if you call too often, the police can make people evict the landlord. And so the mental health part of it isn't money. It's about a separate question, but it's criminalization of poverty. We don't have a decent, and this goes back decades now, I know we all know, it's awful. And so the system really we have, if there is a system, is so many people, because there's no adequate mental health services, they go to jail, they go to prison. And if you look at the numbers, typically in state prisons, it's like 40% of the people there have serious mental health problems. And people die there, and there are awful stories and I write about one of them in Florida, where the people who run the prison are just terrible, horrible people. And they actually scalded a man in Florida because they wanted to. That's awful. But the bigger thing is because we really don't have a mental health system in our country.
Peter Edelman is the author of Not a Crime to Be Poor, The Criminalization of Poverty in America. When we look at that criminalization of poverty, you talk specifically about child support and really the criminalizing of poor fathers in this country.
That's right. And one of the things that I'm trying to do here with this book is to connect these things that seem to be separate and are terrible in and of themselves, but really are part of this pattern how treating low-income people. Now, child support is it couldn't be more important for a father who should be paying it. I mean, that's scum, somebody who has the capacity. But the problem is that there are low-income people who can't pay, in some cases they really should have, but they just can't. And if you throw them in jail, it just makes it worse. It doesn't help. And what we really need to do is to find ways to help people and support and have them be able to have jobs, and so they can help to support the family as well. when you just pick up and throw them in the jail because they didn't pay, and the ones who can't pay, that's just losers all the way around. So that's the story in and of itself, but it's extremely important for the family and for the children.
Is it possible for you, and even in looking at this issue overall, to extricate poverty and race?
You can't. I mean, there certainly are people in all of these stories that we're sort of talking about here and in the book. There are a lot of white people who are cooked, too. I was just reading about Corinth, Mississippi, which is a place where they pick up people and throw them in for these kinds of fines and fees that we're talking about. And they're all white, or largely white. So, but typically, and partly because poverty in our country is disproportionately people of color, that race connects to poverty, not only in what we're talking about, but just generally, problems of poverty in our country, even though the number of people who are poor are more white than they are black or brown, they're disproportionately people of color. And you can't understand poverty in our country if you don't understand race and poverty. They really do. For so many people who are in poverty, they go together.
The longest chapter in the book is the final chapter, which is Turning the Coin Over, Ending Poverty as We Know It. You write, we have to turn the coin over and provide prenatal care for all, child development for all children, first-class education for all, decent jobs and effective work supports, affordable housing, health and mental health, lawyers as needed, safe neighborhoods, no violence on the street or at home, healthy communities, economic, social, racial, and gender justice, and justice rather than charity. Okay. So, how do you do that?
Well, that's a lot of things, isn't it? My
it
point
is.
Was we've done better than we kind of people would say, because the fact is, with various programs and things that we do, if we didn't have Social Security and food stamps and earned income tax credits and all those things, we'd have twice as many poor than we do have. So it's far from a failure of responsibility on the part of our country. But that said, poverty connects up to all those things that you read out, and everyone has their things that are complicated, and so what I did there is say, look, one thing, the toughest poverty is where you have too many people living all in the same area, whether it's urban, inner city, or actually rural. And I went to seven different parts of the country to see what really interesting people are doing, really important work that does cut across the kinds of things that I read out there. Certainly in relation to education and jobs and services that do operate together to make a difference for families and for children. And they're actually doing that in a number of cities in our country. And so if somebody reads all the way through that book and they get to two-thirds through, they're about ready to jump off something or other. And then we're doing something, too. And it's not directly, we need the direct decarceration and getting rid of those terrible fines and fees and driver's license and the bail and all that. That's all absolutely necessary. But we need to go further and do more than we do about poverty. And that's why I put that in that book, because some people, and it's so important to understand that while we need national support and policy, it has to happen in communities and the civic commitment to do things. And so that's that last part.
As I mentioned, you were a top advisor to Senator Robert F. Kennedy from 1964 to 1968. You went on to serve in the Clinton administration during the 90s. You did resign in 1996 in protest over the signing of welfare reform legislation. I'm curious as to what was your issue then, and where do you think we've come from that time?
Well, in the particular part of the lowest income people, what President Clinton did with the law that's called TANF. I won't go through the what TANF, T-A-N-F is what the letters are. Anyway, instead of saying that there was in the old system, which, by the way, was needed a lot of work to help people get jobs, much better than we had ever done, it went the other direction. And what that law says is that the state doesn't have to do anything for anybody. So what you end up with is there were 14 million people, which is too many when Clinton became president, and it's now fewer than 3 million people. We're talking about cash assistance in this conversation. And there are 7 million people in this country now whose only income is from food stamps, is from SNAP, because cash assistance is largely gone in more than half the country, in the country. And we knew that was going to happen when Clinton did that. So I quit because I knew that that was going to come, and unfortunately, I was right. And that part of it, we've done things that are at least help people in our low-wage country that we've come to be. You know, we have the Earned Income Tax Credit and the Child Tax Credit and the food stamps. But people at the very bottom, there are 15 million people who have incomes below half the poverty line. And so it's a bad thing. That is as bad as it was when Clinton signed that into law.
You write in the book, welfare reform joined mass incarceration as a way to do racial politics without using the N-word. Jail for the men, ending welfare for the women and children, with race playing a role in all of it. So we fast forward 23 years or so, we're certainly no better now.
That is true in terms of particularly the people at the very bottom. What we have to remember that we're doing some things right. It's just not nearly enough. Those things I said before in terms of the food stamps and the Earned Income Tax Credit and so on and so on. So we're a little careful, but having said that, there's some things that work, and particularly people who are somewhat up the line, we are not doing well for people who are having the toughest time. That's not got better. It's probably worse.
The name of the book is Not a Crime to Be Poor. It is published by The New Press. Peter Edelman, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. A pleasure.
Thank you. Again, the name of the book, Not a Crime to Be Poor, by Peter Edelman. It is published by The New Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.